Okay, let's jump into our Friday night review of where we are. And as you know, we've been following this since January the 8th and brought you information here first through the good graces of Dr. Henry Nyman, PhD, one of the world's foremost virologists that no one else had. We were really leading the pack on this from the beginning. And it has gone just about exactly where Henry has told us it would go. The numbers continue to rise. Europe, sad to say, more lockdowns. They're doing in Liverpool now, from what I've read, a couple sources, they're going to do mandatory testing now on all the residents of Liverpool. Not my idea of a free society. Masks are enough, quarantines plenty, but there you go. We will see. We will see what happens. Henry, are you there?
Yep, I'm here, Jeff.
Welcome back.
Well, it's good to be back, and it's definitely getting out of control as far as the virus is concerned. So hasn't been quite as much in the news. The news is kind of covered with the election, but
right. No, I haven't seen much of anything. You're right.
Moving up. I mean, you get a little announcement that basically said it set another record, and not a whole lot of detail, but I thought I'd go over that tonight because it is quite dramatic, it's still got a ways to go, and it's kind of moving along as expected, and just as a quick review, there were two waves, if you want, in the spring and the summer, and some were saying, well, that's two waves. This is the third wave in the fall, and if you look at the epi curves, they do go up and they do go down. But the concern, which is a greater concern now than it was a few weeks ago, because it looks like it's becoming a reality, is that the two waves earlier were really just a couple different versions of what's called the Herald wave. So that's the first wave when the virus first makes its introduction. And what was unusual about this Herald wave in the U.S. was that it actually was kind of like two waves. You know, there, it was one in the spring, and then it kind of went down a little bit, never really went down all the way, and then came back again in the summer, and then went down a little bit. And in Europe, for instance, there really wasn't the summer wave. It kind of happened in the spring, and then it went down, and it was pretty low over the summer. And now, as you mentioned, it is going up pretty dramatically in Europe. And a lot of this is probably somewhat seasonal. There are multiple factors. One has to do with the weather. The virus hangs around more and transmits more easily when it's cooler and drier. And that's kind of drier as in lower humidity. And that is kind of one of the characteristics of the fall season, and then it goes into the winter, and there's usually holidays associated with that. So not only does the virus transmit more easily, there's more opportunities for horizontal transmission of the virus from one person to the next, because they're indoors and sharing air is just the virus, and the virus.
Well, we're also
around it.
Approaching the holiday season now, and I know in California, the governor, boy, that guy's he's something else. I guess a lot of people really don't know what to make of him. He's talking about no home gatherings of more than, I forget what the number was. They don't directly come from the governor all the time. I got to be correctly accurate about that. They come from the state agencies. But still, it's every state's different.
Yeah, well,
as we know.
there were warnings that came out. Fauci kind of said 2 or 3 weeks ago that, Thanksgiving may not be that good an idea this year, and, beyond your immediate family type thing. Mm-hmm. And and the reason is that, you travel and virus kind of comes from different areas and then gets, in a household and, this close contact, and then people get infected and leave and take the virus to, wherever they came from originally. So that's one of the ways of spreading the virus. And there's concern. And the concern is, which I had mentioned previously, is that, even though there were two epi curves, if you will, in the spring and the summer in the U.S., it's really both of them were kind of the same thing, but a slightly different time and slightly different location. So they were what's kind of characteristic of this Herald wave. The virus is kind of adjusting to the new population. It's kind of like a bunch of different epidemics where it'll take off in a given area and it'll kind of run its course and it'll, start low, go and peak and then drop down and kind of get under control, relatively quickly and then have the potential to start up again somewhere else. And that's essentially what happened in the U.S. that there was a lockdown in the spring and it really wasn't, per CDC recommendations and instructions that they wanted to see that the virus indeed was declining over, a minimal period of time. And it was pretty much up to the states and many of the states just kind of decided that, they've had the lockdown all long enough and they really weren't going to pay a whole lot of attention to what the viral levels were. They kind of presented the data at their website that may have looked like the virus was going down. But they tended to take the shackles off early and there was still enough virus around and then people thought that it's over. They can kind of resume normal activities and started traveling around more and there were holiday components and it was kind of like, people kind of took off for, Memorial Day weekend and then got up, shortly thereafter, the numbers started to go up and it ended up having a wave over the summer and it was kind of localized. It was more in the U.S. It was more in the South. And what was a little bit concerning was that, it didn't really get that low after the spring and then it bounced back up and then it went higher. Then it started to go down again. It didn't get as low as it did after the spring curve. And now it's getting into the fall and it's going up again. Except
quite a story today, Henry, this is important. I want to get before I forget this. CDC apparently has stopped. I don't know what this means. Stop tracking influenza for the 2021 flu season. This is from the CDC, and I don't know why they would do that. They're shifting, well, for some reason, away from tracking seasonal flu, and I guess focusing on the COVID-19.
Well, the flu is not very intense at this time. It's still a little bit early, but
so that's why they would maybe not, pull off. There's
not a whole lot of flu circulating, and that happened in the southern hemisphere, and I mentioned that. Mm-hmm. And the reason, there's a lot of parallels here. I mean, the coronavirus is not a flu virus. Okay, it's a cold virus. It's a totally different class. Flu is negative sense. Coronaviruses are positive sense. The coronavirus is almost 2.5 times as big as far as its genetic composition. And it's more complex as to how many different proteins are made.
Oh, that's, I've never heard that. You may have mentioned it. It's 2.5 times as big in terms of its genetic composition. That's quite a difference.
Right.
Interesting.
Right. If you sequence any of the coronaviruses, they're all the same. MERS is the same. The original SARS. And then SARS-CoV-2, they're all about 30,000 is what the size of the genome. So it's 30,000 letters. If you do influenza, the size is closer to around 1,400 or so. And, so there's a pretty big difference between them.
Yeah.
And I just got handed that Mark Meadows is positive, but anyway, that's the latest news. I haven't seen that. I just got a note here.
I didn't know.
And it's the opposite sense. I mean they're both single-stranded RNA, but the viruses can be positive or negative sense depending upon how they are compared to messenger RNA that's used in the cell to actually make the protein. So if it's the same as the messenger RNA, it's called positive, and it's the opposite strand, it's a negative. Since it copies itself, it can go from either one. It ends up having to copy itself, so you end up with a positive and a negative one way or the other, whether the negative to make the positive or the positive to make the negative. But they're opposite that way, and influenza is segmented, so there's 8 different segments, and the coronavirus is just one really long segment. But and that's why it's fairly easy to see the recombination. The coronavirus recombines pretty regularly. Everybody acknowledges it recombines. The flu, there's a lot of resistance to saying that it recombines. They say everything's just reassortment. But the bottom line is that even though the two viruses are different in some of those key parameters, they still elicit some of the same responses. So that the cytokine called interferon was given the name interferon because it interferes with RNA viruses. And so that particular cytokine goes up against either type of virus. The flu can elicit an interferon response, and so can coronavirus. And so when you have a pandemic, the host is making interferon to combat whatever they're infected with, and that interferon will offer protection against the other one. So there's a lot of coronavirus going around. People are making interferon to combat the coronavirus, but the interferon really prevents them from getting infected with influenza. And by the same token,
so they're going to close one door and another one opens.
Right. So you're battling one, and that kind of keeps the other one from establishing a foothold type of a thing, because your defenses of one go up against the other, and so the thing doesn't really get going. And that's what happened with the swine flu outbreak. If you recall back in 2009, it kind of showed up in the spring towards the end of the flu season. And it gradually took over. And so it was fairly active over the summer. And the flu, the seasonal flu typically declines over the summer. And so the levels usually go lower for that. But the swine flu kind of persisted over the summer. And then it became dominant. And by the fall, that's all that was circulating. There was no influenza B. There was no H3N2. And there was no seasonal H1N1. Everything was a swine flu. So basically, if you had flu-like symptoms, you ended up having the swine flu. If you tested, if you were influenza A positive, you weren't seasonal H1N1, you weren't seasonal H3N2, you had the swine flu. And that's what happens. It has an advantage. It takes over. And so while you're combating the swine flu, you're basically putting up defenses that keep you from getting affected by the other flus that are normally circulating. And they just kind of disappear. They don't really have a host. Mm-hmm. And they fade away, and everybody's got the swine flu. And then they ended up making a comeback. At least H3N2 made a comeback. Seasonal H1N1 never did. It kind of just got replaced. And I've said this before that these pandemics, they don't just suddenly disappear and go away, as Trump predicted. They end up getting replaced by in the case of the flu pandemics, they get it replaced by another flu virus. And so the one that was circulating is no longer in play, and there's another one that's replaced it. So now the two influenza A's circulating are H3N2, which first made its appearance in 1968, and swine H1N1, which made its appearance in 2009, and seasonal H1N1, which, if you recall, back in 2009 was becoming a concern because it was becoming Tamiflu resistant, and virtually all the seasonal flu was Tamiflu resistant at the time of the pandemic. And the swine flu replaced it, and so it's gone. So the seasonal H1 is gone, as is the Tamiflu resistance. So in any event, the point is that because the pandemic is so widespread with COVID, SARS, COVID-2, the seasonal flu, or flu in general, is levels are way down. And then they not only would be impacted by the cytokines that you're making against the coronavirus, but they'd also be impacted by the wearing masks as well as social distancing, because it's the same thing. The virus has to transmit from one host to the next, and if there aren't hosts around, is very hard for it to continue going. And so the flu levels are down. So far, it's got a very, very slow start. I looked at flu view.
Is this
morning,
because of the weather? It's not
no,
super
it's because
cold
of COVID.
Yet?
No,
so COVID is just kicking it out. Okay, I got it.
Right. The cytokines you make to fight off COVID protect you from being infected by influenza. And so influenza can't really take a foothold.
Interesting.
And then if you're
all dressed up and no place to go. Okay.
Right. If you're wearing a mask, it doesn't transmit that easily. And if you're social distancing, then it doesn't transmit that well. If you go to school or you go to football game, or go and do what you normally would do in the fall, that's not in play, and so those opportunities aren't there, and all of these things are really they're more easily controlled than you might think. Because generally, I mean, the virus can replicate very quickly and can spread mm-hmm. very quickly.
Right.
It doesn't take over the world. I mean, everybody doesn't get the flu at the same time. The flu outbreaks usually, you know, start low, go up, and then go back down again because the hosts have has enough to keep the virus under control. And so there's always this fine balance. The virus can only do so much under the current conditions, and it starts out taking over, and then the defenses are mounted and gets it under control, and it ends up, you know.
Here in the U.S., we've got about, let's just be, I don't know, I'm going to just guess. We've got about 300 million Americans who have not either tested positive or gone through, and well, they wouldn't even know, an asymptomatic cycle of COVID-19. That's a lot of people.
They don't have antibodies, right?
That's right. That's a lot of people yet to be infected. So this thing could run on for a long time, theoretically.
Right, right. And that's why the predictions were, I said this about a month ago, that what I thought would happen is that the Herald wave, the one wave in the spring and the second wave in the summer, we're going to be much smaller than what's going to happen in the fall. The fall, the conditions are better. The virus is more adapted, and there's more opportunities with people being inside, that the level of activity is likely to be much higher. And so when you end up drawing these graphs, what you're going to see is you're going to see that the Herald wave, which had two humps in the U.S. and only one hump in Europe, is going to be a lot mm-hmm. smaller than the fall outbreak. And that's what's happened with other flu outbreaks. That if you recall the swine flu, there was a lot more activity in the fall. In the spring, it was kind of bouncing around, and the people that were infected were people that had, you know, gone to Mexico and on spring break and got infected and came back. You know, a lot of college students came back to school, and then there were outbreaks at individual schools, but it wasn't like there were outbreaks at all the schools. And I mean, the same thing happened here in Pittsburgh. There was, it was one school that had an infection. It was a middle school. It was it didn't really spread that much in the spring. And then in the fall, it was everywhere. I mean, they did an antibody test before the vaccine
in the school,
was distributed.
Everywhere in the school.
And, well, they just basically took serum samples from samples uh-huh. that were collected.
I see.
Prior to the vaccine, to see if those serum samples had antibodies to swine flu. And swine flu is different enough that they could design the assay so that the only antibodies they would pick up was the swine flu. They wouldn't pick up antibodies to seasonal flu, so they could distinguish that it would be specific for swine flu. And they found that in 40% of the population, of the school population. And so it was clear that by, and this would have been, you know, in late November or so, that by November, you know, a high percentage of the student population had been infected by the virus and had already developed antibodies that were detectable by this assay. So it was very widespread, the whole point is, you know, relatively early in the flu season, and usually the peaks in the flu season are in January and February, and this was by November, 40% of the student population had already been infected by the virus and already developed some antibodies. And so it was very widespread. It wasn't at, you know, a school here and a school there. It was at all the schools, and there were absentee mm-hmm. rates and so the number of cases was, you know, like an order of magnitude higher, or one or two orders of magnitude higher in the fall than it was in the spring. And so the concern is that the exact same thing is going to happen with COVID. And it's not that it's going to happen. It's that it in fact is happening right now. And that's what's starting to show up with the numbers. And if you recall, there was talk a month or two ago about the U.S. could see the number of cases going up to 100,000 cases a day. Right. And when that was cited, that sounded like it was a really big number. And because in the first outbreak, the numbers kind of got up to around 40,000 cases a day, and then they fell back. And then when the second outbreak happened, it got as high as 60,000 for a little while. I think it peaked around 65,000. And then it fell back to 40,000. And then it was kind of like, well, it could go up to 100,000, which was, you know, significantly higher than the 40 or 60,000 from the earlier. And now people are no longer talking about 100,000. They're talking about 200,000. and they're using Europe as an example. And the levels in Europe where they're starting to do lockdowns, if they do it at a per capita rate. So if the U.S. is at the same per capita rate as Europe, it would actually be 275,000 cases a day. And just to give you an idea that that's not just kind of an abstract number and say, oh, I don't think it get that high. Here's what happened this week. And this is from, you know, the numbers that are reported by each of the state labs. So these are the 50 states plus the District of Columbia. And typically the numbers are down over the weekend and they kind of start slow during the week. Monday is really picking up, Sunday numbers. So this Monday there were, 84,276. And then, Tuesday it started to go up. It got up to 90,136. And then Wednesday, it set a record. It broke 100 and got up to 103,957. Now it had got up above 100,000 the prior week, but the day that it got above 100,000, there were like 8,000 cases that were positive by a serological test. And it wasn't that they all got infected that same day. That was kind of a batch number, and that's when it was reported. So if you took away those 8,000, it only got up to 98,000. So it really hadn't broken 100,000 until Wednesday. And Wednesday, it got up to 104,000. And then yesterday, it got up to 117,934. So it's up to 118,000. And then today, and it might get a little higher, California's as of 6:36 local time, is now up to 127,171. So
Have there been any changes that you've seen in the strain or configuration of the virus to cause this explosion, or is it simply a result of more tests? What do we got here?
No, it's definitely not more tests. There's more hospitalizations. The deaths are getting a little bit higher. They're lagging in the decay. The deaths are over 1,100 now. It's been over 1,100 every day this week, since Tuesday anyway. There is some more testing because there's more positives, so they're tracking it. But, you know, to answer the question about the testing, you just look at what percentage are positive. And, you know, the CDC would like to see that the positive rate is below 5%, so that, you know, if 19 out of 20 tests are negative, then that's an indication that you're doing enough testing so that you're picking up most of the cases.
Makes sense. Sure, okay.
And
are these PCRs? Are these antibody
or
PCRs?
These are PCR.
Okay.
These are PCR tests, and they're not at 5%. They're at 15%. They're at 20%. Some are as high as 30%.
So that would be the highest we've had, I think, 30%.
So when you're getting 20 to 30% positives, that doesn't mean that you're getting a lot because you're testing a lot. It means that you're not testing a lot. That if you bumped up your testing, you'd get a lot more positives. And so if you wanted to drive it down to 5% positive, you'd have to do, something like six times as much testing, and you'd get a lot more positives. So we're not over-testing. We're under-testing when we're getting that high a frequency. So the frequency of positives goes up. The frequency of hospitalizations go up. So these numbers are going up, not because actually testing has gone down. Trump doesn't like to test people that are asymptomatic. They're not really doing contact tracing. They're really doing herd immunity without actually saying they're doing herd immunity. There is no plan. Great deal of testing. There's not a great deal of contact tracing. And you can see the numbers and realize that, it's totally out of control.
Is it the same in Europe, Henry? Totally out of control? I mean, you saw the pictures of the people fleeing Paris, I guess, to avoid the lockdown. I never saw
so many
cars.
The reason they're doing lockdowns is because it's out of control. Like I said, if the per capita rate were the same here as it is in Europe, we would have 275,000 cases a day. And unfortunately, we likely are going to have 275,000 cases a day in the next several weeks because, in Europe, it can get a little bit cooler, a little bit quicker. It's a little bit further north. And so things can start there a little bit before the United States. If you recall, that kind of happened with the Italian strain. If you remember, back in February, the Italian strain was fully established in northern Italy. And there were examples of people going to see soccer games in northern Italy and coming back with infections. There was a fashion show in Milan, and people from New York went to the fashion show and came back and were infected. And there were others that went to ski resorts
There's very
Northern
great
Italy
concern
and got
in Italy
infected.
Right now.
And that was happening like in January, February. And in January, February in the U.S., we weren't even looking on the East Coast. That all the testing was focused on the West Coast. They were worried about people coming from China. Initially, they were worried about people coming from Wuhan. And that's who was being tested in January and February. If they said, did you travel outside of the country? And you said yes, they'd say where. And if you said Europe, they would say, no, that's good. We're only testing people that are from China. We're only testing people from Wuhan. And so the outbreak in the U.S., there's serological data that indicates that people were infected in the U.S. before the first positives were identified on the East Coast. And those positives really weren't identified until March, the beginning of March. Because I remember I was looking at the data on February 21st, which was the 17th anniversary of the Metropole Hotel. And there were all of these reports coming out of Europe that there was virus that was spreading to Iran. There was virus in northern Italy. And then all these other countries were getting their first case. And most of them had some type of linkage to Northern Italy. There were people that went to soccer games. You know, they were from other countries and they went there. There were, Spain went and sent an entourage because they were having their finals with Valencia and one of the teams in Northern Italy. And then they came back with flu-like symptoms and they kind of hedged as to what they really had. And then the first cases were identified in Africa right after that. And then the first cases were identified in Brazil. And the cases were popping up everywhere except the U.S. The U.S. had no cases from Europe because nobody from Europe got tested. So, of course, they had no cases. They had cases here, but none were identified because as soon as you said you were from Europe, they said, right. Oh, not a problem. We're not testing Europe. We're just looking for people from Asia. So the bottom line is it starts a little bit earlier in Europe, and that's exactly what's happened. So they're doing lockdowns, and they're getting rates that would be equivalent to us having 275 people a day. And today we were you know, about half of that. You know, we were at 127 today. And, yeah, we were 117 yesterday, and we broke 100 for the first time on Wednesday. So we went from 100,000 to 125,000.
Right. Okay.
And it'll dip down for the weekend, and right. then it'll start up
always
again.
Does.
And I'll give you a prediction that by next Friday, a week from today, it usually kind of creeps up to Friday, that in the U.S. will be somewhere between 150 and 175. And a week after that, we'll be up to 200 cases a day. So that this isn't a theoretical or maybe it's going to happen.
200,000 cases a day. Yeah.
200,000 cases a day within the next couple of weeks by Thanksgiving, you know, or a week after.
Oh, happy holidays.
So that is the point. I mean, there were warnings about trying to do Thanksgiving, and some people are going to do Thanksgiving. They're going to kind of say, "Oh, it's just the flu. It's not a big deal." And the rate is going to be sky high, and if people start traveling and have family gatherings, and they're going to get infected, and they're going to come, you know, traveling away from, you know, whatever family they visited, and spread the virus. And if people just ignore it, then the same thing will happen in December. You know, there'll be Christmas break and New Year's break and break from school and travel here and travel there, and the virus will, you know, it might end up going to 300,000 or 400,000 cases a day.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you compare that to the spring or summer, you'll see that, you know, the peaks aren't that comparable. That what was happening in the spring and summer were itsy bitsy peaks. You know, those were the Herald wave was just getting introduced, and the number of cases that happens in the fall is one or two orders of magnitude higher. Okay, what
were
you going to ask?
Avian flu. They've got an outbreak in the UK and Holland, Germany, Israel, Russia, and even in South Korea. The farms are now beginning to cull, apparently, hundreds of thousands of birds. So,
it's that time of the year. The birds migrate in the fall, and they get infected over the summer, and then when they migrate in the fall, they spread the virus, and they come in contact with right. birds on farms, and those farms.
Well, I remember years ago, you remember when we were talking about and explaining to people about the flyways and how they're like highways
right,
for the virus.
It started in 2005 with the Qinghai strain and Qinghai Lake in China, which is the largest lake, and they bopped along and went to Russia and Mongolia and Kazakhstan over the summer, And then they kind of took off in the fall and spread to Europe, and then went to, through the Middle East, and then went on to Africa. And, you know, there were people that were denying it back then. You know, they said dead birds don't fly. That, you know, this is a lethal virus and the birds die. Mm-hmm. And there's no way you can get the virus that starts out in China and ends up in England. And there were scientists, you know, I'd use that term loosely, but I mean, there were people that had been educated in science and insisted that, you know, it was wild birds as victims and dead birds that don't fly. So the wild birds only got infected by coming in contact with birds on farms. And so they were victims. They weren't really the vectors. And mm-hmm. that dead birds don't fly because if the wild birds got infected, they died and they weren't capable of spreading it. And they insisted that the wild birds didn't have anything to do with it. That they were just, you know, they happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. They did get infected, but they weren't moving it around. And it was that went on for years, you know, and every year the same thing would happen. It would follow the same pattern. It would go through those flyways. You'd have the outbreaks at the same locations. You start seeing it in the wild birds with the swans. With the swans, they were big and they were easy to see. And all of a sudden, there were these dead swans on these lakes that were frequented by wild birds. Mm-hmm. So the point is, I'm not surprised. What's causing concern among animals is COVID and minks. So they talk about culling all the mink farms. Correct.
Are raised for their coats and jackets and whatever.
Right. Right.
I guess when they cull them, they'll probably take the fur off if they can. I don't know. Seems like a horrible waste.
I'm not sure how much salvaging there'll be of the furs.
I'm surprised it's a big industry like it is. I it's kind of repulsive when you think about it, because they can make artificial furs now. You can't tell the difference.
Yeah, I mean, it used to be a bigger deal in the past. I thought they
mink stoles, sure.
Fell out of favor, but maybe they made a comeback. I don't know. Yeah, but there are significant mink farms, and it creates a problem. There's, I think there's 277 sequences from COVID from minks that are at GSAD. And it is the Italian strain, and there are several different versions of it now. And the concern is that if you're on a mink farm, the density of the minks is very high, and so it's the same thing with poultry, that you get the virus in there, and it can transmit from one animal to the next, and it can basically infect the whole farm, and then it's got the potential of infecting the farm workers, although in all likelihood, virtual certainty, that these outbreaks on the mink farms started with humans infecting the minks. But the concern is that if it goes into another species and it mm-hmm. transmits efficiently,
right,
then you can come up with new versions that are recombining with coronaviruses that are normally found in mink.
Yeah.
So you can have a virus in mink that you don't usually
see in humans. That's my last question of the night.
And it recombines with the COVID that's been circulating, and then it goes from the mink back to humans, and all of a sudden they've got this newer version of the coronavirus.
So here's my question. Could that be the mechanism by which we come up with the, quote, next generation of COVID-19?
Yeah.
That's one way.
It definitely could. Or it could be other coronaviruses that are in humans. Mm-hmm. And it could be another species that, you know, It could be species that are at a zoo. I mean, the issue with a mink farm is you've got this interface there. The mink farm, you've got mink farms and mink farmers, people that are employed at the farm. They're taking care of the animals, and so it's easy for the virus to go from the animals to the humans. So when you have that interface, and humans are with animals, and the animals basically get a virus and then it contains a little bit and then go back into humans, you can have that happen. And the mink farm's a good example because these are high-density targets. So when the virus goes in there and it's high-density, it can transmit from one mink to the other and get to a high level, and then people taking care of
the mink. Do
they
get sick, Henry? Do the mink get sick and die from this form of COVID?
You know, I'm not sure, but usually when this happens, they kind of get milder versions of it. I mean, there's examples of the virus showing up in dogs and cats. Mm-hmm. Some of the older animals can have a fatal infection. Others basically are asymptomatic or have milder symptoms. It's kind of the same thing, that you run through this whole spectrum of activity. I mean, most humans that get infected with COVID don't die, and because of the asymptomatic spread, a high percentage of them don't even get symptoms. So the virus, mm-hmm. It depends how hard you look for it. And and how much testing you do. And,
what are they testing the minks with? PCR?
Yeah, it's the same test. A PCR, mm-hmm. PCR test doesn't matter what the target.
What species?
Samples from. I mean, you can take a nasal swab. It's on the virus is on the swab, and mm-hmm. and you do the test. If they're infected with SARS-CoV-2, then it's the same. It's the same virus, might have a mutation here or there, but the tests are designed to pick up virus even when it does have mutations, because the virus does pick up mutations, and the test targets multiple regions of the genome and picks regions that are unique for the SARS-CoV, so they aren't picking up other coronaviruses, and you have more than one location, so even if there's a mutation in one of them, you can still pick it up with a couple of the other ones, a couple of the other probes. It's the same assay, and it's the same thing. You're just taking some type of, I mean, it doesn't have to be nasopharyngeal. I mean, you can do a throat swab or, so if you just get a swab into the upper respiratory tract of the mink, you can get a sample and see whether they've got the virus. So the assay is still essentially the same assay. And it's been around for a while. I mean, these isolates that are as she said, go back to March. I mean, they're between March and September for the collection dates. And like I say, last time I looked, there were 277. And virtually all of them are the Italian strain. But they've got, I mean, the virus has been around for a while. So it's picking up more and more mutations. So it's got the background, it's got the mutations that showed up in the Italian strain, but then it's got a whole series of new ones tacked on top. And that's what, the other concern of the virus that gets in the human population, when it gets into the human population and the number of infections get very, very high. Then you've got the potential of two different viruses being in a human or like I said, recombining with another human coronavirus, or potentially recombining in another species like a mink or a dog or a cat or a wild cat at a zoo.
Yeah.
And then it can jump and infect visitors to the zoo, type of thing. And that's what happens. It gets in the species, it can change, there can be some selection, mm-hmm. and then you can have a brand new wave, and all of a sudden the virus seems to be able to cause, you know, it's more easily infect, and people don't have immunity, and they have a lot of cases.
No.
So COVID-20. That's where we stand, but I'll say that the infection rate by a week from today will be at least at 150, but probably at 200,000 cases a day, and
wow.
heading up. So,
all right.
That's
thank
where
you.
We
Good
stand.
Job. Have a wonderful weekend, Henry. It's been quite a week.
Okay. Take care. Talk to you.
You
Bye-bye.
Too. Good night. Okay, gang, and the same goes for all of you out there. This was an extraordinary and difficult week to walk through, and it's not close to being over. But just remember what we said earlier tonight in the program. You'll know by how much energy is put into fighting this as to whether or not it's being allowed. All right? Okay. Take care. You know where you can find us, and we'll talk to you very soon.